Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to round two of this total knockout episode of the Cyber Show with your hosts, Ed Navarre and Farnell, Helen Blue.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Cyber Show. We've covered a lot. So now maybe let's start moving on to our conclusions.
Maybe it helps if we break that down into two parts, the technical and political.
Okay, well, I'll start with the technical side. I'm interested here in the development process. How is it that a company like Fujitsu allowed a prototype to go into at-scale production? I think the software engineering is really failing here. There's no way credible project management was performed.
And there's the whole thing about formal methods. Why in this century are we not requiring software formalism for such high-profile designs? I think Europe are leading the way with program proving in new software engineering directives, but enforcing that, I don't know. I'm not sure it's possible to legislate for good software, which leaves liability incentives, but those are limited too. Compensation, even the reported £600,000 per claimant that we've heard of, wouldn't put lives back together. I was very saddened reading a blog post by Ian Somerville, who was like a god to me when I studied software engineering. I assume it was an authentic post. He seemed depressed and said that the whole project of software engineering, in which he'd played a main role in defining, had kind of failed. He said something like, "I've wasted my time." It was like that time I read Sir Tim Berners-Lee expressing regrets about the World Wide Web. It actually made me cry. I think the reason the whole act of software formalism, metrics, and engineering has failed is that despite there being ways to make highly reliable software, the world doesn't want engineered software.
We want a software industry that's in constant total free market turmoil. Everyone nods and pays lip service to software engineers, safety and cybersecurity. But what they really want is a convenient app for that that's free to download and doesn't make anyone think. And it doesn't matter if it's total crap, because next month there'll be a new one and the decision maker who rolled it out will have moved on. We want cheap software and we want it now. Technology being a cheap and easy solution to everything has become part of culture and mythology of digital tech. People say, let's just automate that, or let's build a system to handle that.
In the early days of computers, those marginal gains were huge, and so the effort was worth it. But today, software complexity and cybersecurity landscape has really changed things. If we look at the total cost of ownership, the TCO of requirements gathering, design, proving, testing, maintenance, and potential liability, then a lot of overcomplex solutions end up looking very bad value compared to sticking with an old and working system of tickets, paper and pens and telephones. What's driving a lot of development in the early 21st century is not actually economic. It looks like economic reasoning on the face of it, but only because huge externalities have been imposed upon society, miscarriages of justice being only one of them. It's ideologically driven now. The drive to digitise everything, to make everything legible to a central brain, has taken on its own logic.
Let's move on and talk about the legal side now. The initial trials, the ones that convicted postmasters of fraud, they seem to rest on poor standards of evidence. At least it looks that way to me as a computer engineer.
Where are the documented requirements and unit tests? Where are the bug tickets? Important documents were not shared. So no judges ever had what you'd call direct experience. And the problem with digital evidence is that it's not verifiable or repeatable in a scientific sense.
Yeah, not even with strong cryptographic assurances. I don't think people realise how detailed and precarious computer forensics are. And how many ways are there to cover up? Plant evidence, change a little file here or there, misattribute and shift blame problems onto others. And then you've got to get people to cooperate, unless you do have a physical Dawn raid and seize all their servers. System owners have all the time in the world to delete records, hide logs, and cover up their tracks.
So the outcomes come down to reputation, and that's obvious because Jo Hamilton got a comparatively favourable outcome. Her whole village showed up to defend her. And maybe that was as close to genuine justice as we've seen since the late Middle Ages. I'd say the judges knew damn well the whole thing was a sham. But if it's your word against a giant corporation embedded with the government...
It seems like the whole thing rested on the legal presumption of the correctness of software. I mean, guilty until proven innocent by a team of highly skilled and expensive experts.
We should have the opposite. We should presume incorrectness. Software engineers say there's always one more bug. The design specification is a sacred document. Specifications, errors and development logs ought to be public property in software that's used in public or critical services. They can serve as contracts and evidence to be tested against a presumption of failure in cases like this. Prosecution must give a very compelling case with formal proofs and detailed logs that satisfies expert independent computer scientists and witnesses. We have to move to the computer was at fault, now prove otherwise.
I think that would really improve standards of software engineering too.
Oh, another thought. We should keep looking out for similar cases where technology is responsible for absurd and unhuman outcomes. And those where humans nonchalantly, even smugly, neglect to investigate, or very deliberately choose not to. Here's one from the weekly comments section of Bruce Schneier's site. Commenter under the handle John Knows Nothing writes, a mainstream media report of a pensioner who was declared dead and had their pension stopped had some difficulty in proving that they were very much alive. Here's an indicator of how it happens. 1. UK Department for Education oversees teachers' pensions. 2. It's a normal vetting procedure that regularly checks pension beneficiaries against the death register. 3. Death register entries may be matched to scheme members even if personal details differ. So, how do they do it? The intended output is to remove the dead from the payments register. So how do they remove live people from the payments register? How do you get matched with a record where personal details differ? How different can the records be? The Department for Education said it would make an exception and decouple the name from the deceased. This is the fourth time such decoupling failed.
Well, four cases doesn't look like much. But that's always the start. Not nipping it in the bud right now would be negligent. It comes back to your point that mandatory investigations at the systems level should be triggered whenever a single case like this comes up.
Whoa, I just felt a disturbance in the force. Do you feel it too?
As if a million CISOs suddenly cried out in pain and then fell silent.
Everyone is thinking, that's impossible. Think of the cost. Investigations cost a fortune. Even one per year would be too much.
And investigation doesn't have to be a big thing. You can build it in if you treat user complaints and some events like a legal case as normal exceptions. Modern programs should be able to ingest and process that. The moment someone like Joe Hamilton said, I think there's something wrong with the system, that should have started a process that would be traceable and accountable and public. Yeah, I mean, part of the power of this is a kind of open thinking. And so it's also a weakness against those that want to hide things. The weakness is that it would need to be public or very easily be obtainable under freedom of information rules.
We ask companies to keep public financial records. Having selected public IT records, at least a mandatory log of serious complaints, those that show meeting a minimum standard of fitness, that could be a useful thing. Like going to company's house or some rating site, people would be able to see the technical competence of a company.
Yeah, if we'd had that, those postmasters would have all gotten together a lot sooner if they'd known there were others.
So no, I don't think that's a low threshold, because probably other cases will quickly come to light, even in the first stages of the investigation. But maybe that's not the solution. Things like this are happening all around the world. I read harrowing stories from India and China, places where they're pushing highly automated governance much more aggressively. Most of these involve people simply being deleted from critical systems due to a mistake or bug. After that, they are kind of delisted from society. Their bank accounts get closed. They can't pay bills or earn money. Their benefits disappear. And there's no one to appeal to. And if you go to any authority or office, the first thing they do, even before anyone will speak to you, is ask for an ID. And when that comes up as invalid, well, you're lucky if you're not arrested for fraud and then detained in limbo for months as a non-person who can't be processed. It's madness, putting near religious trust in systems that we know fail. Adding more checks and balances only increases misplaced trust in systems that can and will go wrong.
So you blame the system?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm pointing a finger at the widespread misplaced trust in systems.
Okay, I want to talk about blaming the system for a moment. Or as I'm thinking of that Simpson episode where Homer gets his little rocking bird to take care of the nuclear power plant.
I got someone to cover for me.
Stupid bird!
Yeah, so in all these IT foul-ups, the can gets kicked around until it falls into the weakest spot or a scapegoat can be made. The best place to minimise pain and blame is to blame the system itself.
Yes, as if it were an anthropomorphised sentient entity. System scapegoating is a way to make blame disappear.
I think we're seeing a very uncomfortable thing we need to face, where politics meets engineering. There's an implied narrative. Firstly, that software can be built reliably at that scale, and that we know how to fix things and continually improve. Software engineering says that this doesn't follow. Exponential complexity growth has changed things, and people are still acting as if it's the 1980s and you can fix a serious bug with a soldering iron. Software is now somewhat a living thing. It grows like fungal mycelia. It has a life cycle and an interconnectedness.
There isn't a system, just lots of little systems being born, working for a while, and then dying and being replaced, or not, by new systems.
That seems a more natural and realistic way to see things.
Maybe if we face the problem that we can't build enormous monolithic things like Facebook, for example, and also make them reliable and safe. Computer science and 50 years of software engineering tells us that almost all of the time we can't.
So we should not and must not treat them as if they were safe, as we do now. A cultural assumption of the fallibility of technology, a lack of idolatry, that's what's missing now.
No, it's just people going against common sense for the sake of getting by. Think about steam engines. When people invented them, we started to make bigger and bigger, got more and more power, but they exploded. They were too big. Systems theory tells us that there is a natural maximum safe capability for any system, any technology. In that case, iron, steel, and coal. People realized that the machinery was too dangerous. Remember Zeppelins? No, nobody alive remembers Zeppelins because hydrogen balloons haven't carried passengers since the Hindenburg in 1937. So we had to design stuff at appropriate scale and risk level for the materials and application. One way is to have many more smaller machines. We can still use hydrogen to put weather telemetry and drones up, just not people. Today we face the same problem in civic computing. Our steam engines are exploding. There's a new question of whether too much of a digital society is safe. We have a general problem of over-centralization and cloud monopolies. There's a handful of giant tech megacorps who we all think are amazing, but they aren't special, not in a way that makes them trustworthy. They make big mistakes just like everyone else. They can be cheapskates and penny pinchers and often hire bad people, just like anyone else. They are just human, just like any other company. But worse in so many ways. Clumsy, slow, and bad-tempered. Was a cybercrime committed? Do we have a name for it?
No. There's no special new thing here. It's a story about bullying, incompetence, vanity, all the usual usuals.
The post office invested in trust as a brand value, and it was unable to acknowledge and process its own failure at trust when those happened.
I think that's spot on. And that's what created a spiral of silence internally. Andy, you mentioned idolatry. Is treating any system as if it were itself a living, never mind divine, authority wrong?
It's foolish, but it's also sometimes a deliberate diffusion or abdication of responsibility. And it can simply be a clear symptom of incompetence.
I've got here a quote from James Christie, an independent IT auditor, that, quote, "For software testers and for IT auditors, the big lesson that they should take to heart is that bad software and dysfunctional corporate practices hurt people, and damage lives.
Right, and so I think the current commercial culture of software production is unfit for purpose and a giant societal liability. Long-tail maintenance, deploy and update in the field, is a bankrupt philosophy. Working and secure software shouldn't need updates like that. We have to move out of the 20th century with software.
And another quote here from Computer Weekly from a former Fujitsu employee, quote, "Our job was to fix these problems as they arose. We all knew the code wasn't fit for purpose and needed rewriting. The data dictionary was still being added to when I got there."
So I've got a few ideas, right? Always, always question technology. Would that be fair to say?
Well, we do, because it's our job.
And other people should too. At least, let's treat anyone who defends it but is unable to prove their technical understanding or produce supporting data as suspicious.
Going along with faith-based assurances needs to be a thing of the past, because AI is now going to make all of this much worse. I mean, technology can fail in non-technical ways. There's actually a book called Questioning Technology, published in 1988 by Freedom Press, an anthology of essays edited by John Zerzan and Alice Carnet.
And I think we can say compensation is not enough. And so we can't rely on a liability culture when more is at stake than money. So we know technologies can be dangerous and we can't just deploy and defend them, then claim ignorance. We have to maintain quality at a level accordant with risk and impact. The risk can't be pushed down by corporate irresponsibility onto the weakest. And so this is a cybersecurity problem as it relates to the civic cybersecurity of the general public.
We're going to get deeper into law today and talk about some very surprising things in British law.
I would call them draconian because I think that it just hasn't been updated, hasn't it?
Actually, it has been updated. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is this 1999 bill that changed things. So before 1999, there was no presumption of correctness of computer programs. And then in 1999, the UK changed it to basically mean that whatever a computer says is right. Which is completely criminally insane, if you think about it. I mean, so we're going
to
think that was in Nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that look like from a computer scientist or software engineer's point of view?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a very important response to the scandal written in Nature in the editorial of the 23rd of January 2024. I thought that this was a very, very insightful bit of commentary. The title of the piece is "Computers Make Mistakes and AI Will Make Things Worse. The Law Must Recognise That." Quote, "One aspect of the scandal has attracted comparatively little attention, that the laws of England and Wales presume that computer systems do not make errors, which makes it difficult to challenge computers' output. National and regional governments around the world where these laws exist need to review them, as there are implications for a new generation of IT systems, namely those using artificial intelligence."
Well, I don't think we even need to invoke AI to see why this is monstrous.
Sure, AI adds deliberate errors, noise and chaos into computation, making it more like analog electronics. AI already brings back into law balances of probability. But we don't need to talk about that to see why the law is completely wrong here.
Presumption of correctness shows that psychologists would call a catastrophic split between reality and fantasy. The idea that computers are infallible is a very childish fantasy, some relic of early science fiction and 1980s culture. For there to be such a disconnection between the law and reality in 2024 is at the core of this scandal, and it needs addressing urgently.
Quite simply, it goes against all the theoretical and practical evidence that we have from computer science and software engineering. Anyone who has studied formal methods and complexity will understand that it's not even possible in theory to construct a 100% reliable system, even if they're simple, let alone so complex that nobody can list all of the libraries they use. Here's an excerpt from the Nature editorial. "During the 1980s, in the early days of personal computing, the law did not presume that a computer's operations were correct. Rather, proof to this effect was needed for computer-generated information to be allowed as evidence in courts. That law was changed in 1999 in recognition of the fact for very small values of fact that the reliability of computers had improved, but the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction.
We had it right before 1999. Computers have got a lot less reliable for a long list of reasons. The fact that they are used in so many aspects of life makes the required quality standards we need much higher. It's hard to say whether software engineering has improved at all. Software engineers disagree, but some of the most respected have said we are fighting a losing battle against complexity. Project management has got better, so we can build bigger things. Complexity has exploded, literally by orders of magnitude during a sustained two decades of exponential growth. Computers and software today looks nothing like those that existed when this law was passed in 1999. The nature of computing is changing from single machines to distributed, massively parallel architectures where race hazards and inconsistencies are more frequent. Coincidentally, 1999 is the same year that the British government procured the Horizon system from Fujitsu. Cybersecurity is a thing today. We have a global digital crisis. Most systems are insecure and prone to malicious or fraudulent misuse. To make a presumption of correctness is to make a de facto choice in favour of the system owners. It's all absolutely unconscionable to anyone who knows the least thing about computers.
Now let's add AI into the mix. I'm not talking about the egregious uses of AI against citizens. I'm sure that there are already too many to count, but I'm talking about software reliability. Programmers already use AI to write the programs. Even the most optimistic scientists and programmers are saying that AI is already making code quality and security much worse. And that's really only 1 year into the latest wave of AI tools.
At this point, we're literally playing dice with the superstructure that supports civilization.
We can expect code coming down the chute, code for core, key infrastructural needs, to be increasingly flawed. We need to prepare society for that, and so the law needs to change too.
It's so bad with AI coming in. That's a huge problem as well. That's a huge problem. That means that we can't question the numbers that an AI is given back. That means that if an AI deems you, I don't know, unfit for insurance, you can't argue that under any circumstance in law. That's insane.
Yeah, it's a recipe for completely arbitrary injustice.
They're about to turn everything on, right, to the internet, everything onto a system like that. Then everything is corruptible and it's not acknowledged by law that that's even a case.
I think the legal system will collapse at that point.
Yeah.
I really do. I'm serious. I don't think it can sustain the onslaught of what dysfunctional technology is going to bring.
So what do we do? Return to the laws of the 1990s?
Yes, basically.
Surely, if we restore the presumption of incorrectness, everyone who doesn't want to pay a bill will claim computer error and then win in court, right?
Did everyone who didn't want to pay a bill do that in 1998?
Well, I guess no.
Right, to people who say a presumption of incorrectness would be unworkable, they had better remember 1998, when it was workable. It did work, and so therefore it can work. It's like with all arguments that involve power and societal externalities, like fossil fuels. Justice can and should shift the costs of technology back onto those that profit from it most. What we're seeing in the post office scandal is the Torrey Canyon or Exxon Valdez of the information age. Trust in private technology imposes an externality upon society, just as surely as a chemical factory. It's been hard for us to see it, like we don't see the environmental pollution and climate change creeping up on us. One of the symptoms of that externality is massive injustice. Other symptoms are invisible exclusions and disenfranchisements. We're building a technological underclass that makes the wealth divide look egalitarian.
So what are the solutions?
I think the greatest immediate leverage comes from the law. We need to stop letting tech be a scapegoat that gets every incompetent person off the hook and excuses and hides laziness and wrongdoing. Yeah, here's another quote from the Nature article. Some lawyers and researchers involved in the defence of those prosecuted by the Post Office are advocating a different approach. Paul Marshall, a barrister at Cornerstone Barristers in London, and his colleagues argue in an article that the presumption that computer evidence is reliable needs to be replaced with a requirement that relevant data and code will be disclosed in legal cases. So kudos to Paul Marshall and the guys at cornerstone barristers. It's really good to get this ball rolling, but I don't think it goes nearly far enough. I think it's a bit tepid. What we need is to revert to the presumption of innocence, that when an assertion by a human meets a contrary assertion by a machine, the human wins every time by default.
Sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
I wanted to sort of end on a couple of fairly positive points and offer solutions rather than it just being like three people complaining about the world. One of them was like, we should sort of end on this like massive big up to the post office of like, that actually we really love the post office. It's like where you buy stamps and that the iconoclasm, all of that, you know, the tragedy of the fact that the people there really believe in their brand, right? You know, and this has completely rubbed its nose in the mud, and they need to understand why. But it shouldn't be an attack on the post office as an institution. You know, it has to be public awareness about why the law about technology is completely broken and why a lot of technology is completely broken. But that doesn't mean it's the post office's fault. Even more bold is to take the like the pariah, which is Venels. Paula Venels. And yeah, I mean, like, people are basically ready to put a stake in the ground and burn her, right, at the moment. So, so, you know, I thought that was a really sad scene in a documentary of her sitting in a little Anglican church on her own, sort of praying for her soul. I think there is a sort of deep moral thing there. And it's to say, well, look, isn't in some sense, is she a victim? And like, everyone's, whoa, how can you say that? Burn the witch! Burn the witch! Burn the witch! And then we'll be like, oh, hold on a minute. You know, what does Paula Venels know about technology? Absolutely jack shit, right? So,
yeah.
I'm not excusing her psychopathy, but there's a reason that she's ended up in such a conflicted position, trying to defend technology that she
doesn't understand. Right up until the very last minute, she didn't seem to understand what she had been reading for years or overseeing for years, because she then sent that message that said, please tell me there's no back doors in this. It's like, well, you've been looking at this for years. You've been dealing with this for years. You should know by now there are back doors all over it. Have you still asked that question 5 minutes before an inquiry?
Yeah.
And why are you asking that? Aren't you supposed to be in charge? And that's what I feel like. Is she? I don't think she was in charge. It's almost like she's the figure on the postage stamp, right?
Yeah.
Not real. There are a board of predominantly people we're not going to hear from who financially profited with bonuses. And do you know what I was going to bring up as well? I had a friend who worked for the post office when I was back as being a barmaid. And he left right when it became privatised, because he said that everything changed. It was the working conditions and pay was reduced significantly, and it all went to some mysterious guys that had bought the company. And I feel like she's working for them. Isn't this an issue of privatisation of a public service?
Yeah, it definitely is. And there's a parallel article that's just come out, and it's about Boeing. And I was reading this article about safety issues at Boeing, and it was heartbreaking. It's written by a physicist or an aeronautical engineer, and talking about what happened to the culture of engineering and safety over the years. Boeing has been infiltrated by what he called a culture of financial bullshit. And, you know, just to read that, you can say, okay, this is going on everywhere. It's what we've seen in the university system, where the universities are just taken over by professional management and really vile culture that's just rendered them unfit for teaching and learning and research, that the universities are screwed now. And so...
it's like toxic capitalism.
Yeah, it is.
You know, late stage capitalism is maybe reaching all of our institutions now, apart from maybe the ones that are still publicly owned. Maybe that's why we saw that shift from that employee, that when something becomes public, it therefore starts to become toxic from this drive to earn more money. And we're seeing that across everything, all systems in late stage capitalism. I feel that it's a symptom that's affecting all of our companies.
Yeah,
the swan song of capitalism. What does that mean if our institutions are going to fall apart now?
Well, there's ways to fix it. It's just about balancing things again. We've done this before. We've done this multiple times to keep this system alive. We just have to redistribute wealth. And I think that we've reached a pivotal point where that needs to happen. We're in a worldwide capitalist system now, and it's held in such a few number. And then there's this sort of greed and this drive that club maintains itself. I feel that that might have been behind the post office to some extent.
No, I don't disagree. I don't think that redistributing wealth is the key point here. It's about redistributing power. And what's changed, I mean, other than the fact that we've got a 0.1% like owning all the actual capital, but you've got 1% of people there owning all the technological power. And that has massively magnified what's kind of going on already with the money.
But with money comes power, and power is money. So the two things are connected. If someone's got more money than the biggest governments in the world, how are you supposed to say, can you behave yourself? And I guess that's in the situation that we're in. And we're going to keep seeing that, and it's going to keep causing more problems. And I guess that's what we're seeing with the post office. They were above the law because of power, but also potentially because of money. And also a need for systems to be working, because it was a public-facing system. It still had some connection, right, with the government, with the public. That can't seem to be fallible. It might reflect on the government as well. So there's another edge to that. So exactly what you said, it points out that the system has flaws, is in our whole world system, as opposed to just one IT system. It brings in maybe a lot more into play, which we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess we should probably talk about the community side of the post office, and you know how it's been, the post office itself has actually been such a community staple for years now. And although there's a lot of blame at the people at the top, you know, we're not going to hear from 90% of the people that were involved in this entire scandal and that have profited from it. You know, there's a couple of figureheads that are all over the news, but in the bigger sense of things, I don't think we're actually going to hear from the people that have made the most money out of all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No, and the people that are getting spattered with the most mud, it's like, yeah. Oh, there's the postman delivering his letters. All is well in
and
the world.
And that starts young, right? I was talking about Postman Pat earlier, but it starts really young. We've all been children singing that song for generations now. I mean, we're on like the third generation in our family to know Postman Pat as children. So, you know, it's part of our British culture to have our post delivered and to have that community. And that's what that's all about, actually, that show. And so when you're growing up as children, you're watching this hit TV show that shows that the heart of the community is the post office.
Yeah, and I think it's also a bit of a...
It's great when it's a private corporation, right?
Yeah, and those kind of people, they're the ones that really believe in that brand, and they're the ones that actually uphold, you know, your local post office guy. The one that's in my village, he's been running it for, you probably know him, he's been running it for like 30 years. And that is, to me, that is what the post office is. It's not.
But at some point, it became a private company. Exactly. And at some point, it becomes a private company. You get these middle managers that come in, and that community is taken away from that. That heart, that message that it became, the thing that built the brand and the trust in the first place, is put aside in the name of shareholder value.
Yeah.
So how do we big up the post office then? How do we end on something that's, this may be called the post office scandal, but it's not. It's the Horizon IT scandal, and it's a scandal of shareholder value above community, and it's a scandal of ignorance about technology and people being incompetent in what they're doing, and etc. And it's a much bigger problem than the post office.
Well,
don't
mirror
blame
Jeremy,
the post office.
To mirror Jeremy Corbyn's sort of words, maybe we should give the post office back to the community where it belongs and where it should be.
Well, I think it's important that we say that this isn't and it shouldn't be an attack on the post office. It's not specifically the post office's fault. It's more of a kind of awareness about why law on all this kind of tech stuff is just completely broken.
Mm-hmm. Everybody feeling this, engineers at Boeing saying that, you know, their safety culture has been completely replaced by financial bullshit, what happened at the universities and so on. And also that these kinds of gross injustices that are rooted in technology happening all around the world, people are being basically deleted from society, pensioners that can't get their pensions anymore, people that are just kind of locked out of the system, and nobody is capable or prepared or courageous enough to do anything about it. They're just bowing down before their bloody system.
Do you know what? That reminds me of a story that I saw yesterday, because it went on for 20 years. There was that guy that was stuck in the Paris airport for like 20 years, it turns out. He had the film made about him.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah, that story is just this story very similarly, is that he had no papers and somebody had to make an effort to make a decision outside of the computer system to do something about it. But everyone said, well, he needs to go and do this thing himself, we can't help him. But everybody said that, and it was impossible for him to do that. And you're just putting impossible situations around him, because nobody would take the step to look at the human qualities of the story, to actually listen to him. They just went on a computer and it said, no, can't.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I go for the psychological interpretation. It's just a complete and utter failure of humanity. Mm. And whatever in culture has led us to that point where people will literally watch somebody else die or rot in jail than challenge a mm-hmm. system. That's a complete loss of humanity.
Something that's not quite as bad, but our kind of situation at university where the university is running a cybersecurity course, but there's no infrastructure within there. And when you go to the IT team to say, we need access to this website or this service or this port number, we're under supervision from a qualified teacher to do X, Y, and Z task, they go, no, sorry, that's against our policy and we're Microsoft partners and we're not allowed to do this. And you think,
because it saves money.
What it is that there's actually nobody in charge at the top. There's nobody competent and capable in charge at the top.
Right. Someone's looking at a spreadsheet. This is what happens when you get the middle managers come in and they go, right, we're going to look at the spreadsheet. We're going to follow the data. And we're recently getting reports that there's been huge critical errors that have happened because of the bugging in Excel, because everyone's using Excel. Mm. There are massive bugs in it, and it's not really fit for purpose, but people follow it like it's got, you know, the data is absolutely 100%. So we have to follow it. And they're following this blind data that's got bugs in it. And then just do it. They're not looking at the humanity side or listening to people or really thinking in depth. They're going, well, my number said no. Or the system says no. And it's and because we're keep enforcing this in law and with these sort of cases coming up, I guess we're just saying, it's like the old, you know, was it Little Britain computer says no. We're still doing that.
Yeah.
And we're doing it more and more and more because it's a convenient excuse and we don't really want to investigate, not only in our jobs, but as a company that don't want to spend the money on all that.
I think there's a general over-reliance and trust, really misplaced trust, in technology in general throughout society. And it's almost like its own pandemic, really, spread to everyone. And they're just trusting what you can read in front of the screen in front of you. They think, oh, if the computer says that, then it must be true. And there's no further thought of thinking, well, hang on a minute, on a human basis, this makes no logical sense whatsoever. It's just, oh, we better follow what the computer says.
And now we go into the future where we've got AI and we're meant to be monitoring the systems to make sure they're okay. Are humans going to be able to do that as a result? Or are they just going to go, well, the system said, and then someone's going to be saying, but it's your job to make sure the system's right. And they're like, yeah, but the system's always right. It just feels like you'd be in this loop with someone going, but you are paid to critically check that. And they're like, but the computer's always right. Like, they just can't get over it. Like, it's just become so ingrained. Like, they can't even question it.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying because AI could just, that's another, like, you know, if it is going to take over, if it is going to take control and start making decisions, it's really easy when you've got people who just believe anything it says at any face value.
A technological idiocracy.
Right. Mm. And that gets back to education, doesn't it? Why are children not learning that programs are all completely broken because they're all human and not gods?
Shall I go down to the comments gathered up from around the place, from Hacker News, Cryptogram, Reddit, Krebs, all kinds of sources? And I've just kind of mushed them and synthesized them together a bit for brevity, really. Mm. I'll just read them out one at a time and we can discuss them. The primary way the post office got around public awareness was to charge and convict people in isolated segments, similar to how the NSA was able to refute their illegal data harvesting in the USA by smearing the reputations of anyone who challenged them and threatened them with extreme jail terms. The UK post office, Fujitsu, and their mainframe Horizon smeared the names, lives, and imprisoned anyone who challenged them publicly.
They did. That's exactly what they did. And I think the reason that all three of them did is it wasn't just to protect the current system or the current choices that are made. I think Fujitsu are probably doing quite a lot of systems that are critical in the UK across the board that we might not know about. Some we do. Someone's worked out the cost of replacing maybe government or NHS systems that may be in that category or made with the same, you know, core programming code might need replacing. The cost could go into billions and billions and you might not literally have the money to do so. But it's easier to hide it. Throw people under a bus because 20 billion is a lot of money.
My challenge to that is it about money or is it ideological? Because if you think it's just about money, then that doesn't really fit with that comment about the NSA. I mean, the NSA, they're untouchable by economics, right?
Yeah.
They didn't attack and smear people for reasons of money.
No,
they attacked and smeared them because for ideological reasons. How dare you challenge this system? This is a system we've built, and this is what happens to people who challenge our system.
What?
And I think that mentality is still there inside the post office. So you've got like a double-layered cake of unquestionable state power plus the unquestionable imaginable role of finance, and they see themselves as beyond scrutiny.
Yeah, I think it's also important to mention there that, you know, as we spoke about earlier, they mounted a very private prosecution, and that was one of their massive powers here. The fact that they did that and the police wouldn't touch it, as we said, already says a lot about how this all went wrong.
It's a trust issue as well, isn't it? Because if we do have other systems, and I've been reading some newspaper reports on potential systems, such as benefit systems or pension systems, that could have a lot of the same problems, and we're seeing a lot of that now. If that's the case, then it can open up the doors to so many other cases, to so many other situations that companies and indeed the government may be aware of. You could have disabled people that are due thousands in disability benefits because there has been a software error. You could have NHS patients who've been injured as a result of a software failure. And so when they started looking into this, it might have been a much deeper problem. And it would open up a lot, and it would stop people trusting technology. And that could be a huge problem. If we found out that a load of people died unnecessarily from cancer, for example, because of a software error.
They did. And there was a very famous case in software engineering called the Therac 23 case, a radiotherapy dosage machine, and it had an error in the software, and it basically irradiated all the patients and killed them. And that's actually a landmark case in software engineering, and it's quoted in all the textbooks. You know, that was the beginning of serious software engineering. And I think that what's happened since then is that we've regressed. All of the gains made in formal methods and software engineering and software regulation have just crumbled. And that's why that quote from Ian Somerville just really saddened me. Nobody wants good software. Nobody wants it. It's just not part of our culture. And that's really tragic. And to go back to your point, Helen, about, well, people will lose trust in technology, and that's a problem. Yeah, who's it a problem for? Because I don't think that's a problem. I think people should lose trust in technology. Yes. I think it's absolutely vital for the survival of the human race.
We all do,
that we stop trusting in technology the way that we do, because that is the way to bad things.
Right, that's the point of the show today, and that's the point that we're trying to make. But someone somewhere, and a lot, well, we know who, particularly in the post office case, but people are making that decision to say, no, we have to trust the computer. Because I guess that they're seeing, well, hang on, this system could fall down, and this system could fall down, and then where are we going to be? We're being cavemen, you know, back to reduced to no technology at all. I think they see it like a house of cards, when it's not. You know, pointing at one program and saying, well, this particular program hasn't been done properly, let's fix it, is not the same as, say, if all programs are broken because this one is. And that's not how the public have reacted to this. It's that we know that this system's got a problem.
I think, as also, it's so deeply ingrained in our society, this, like, trust in all sorts of technology. If it's come from what you might consider as, like, a reasonable source, like the NHS, for example. The look on the receptionist, for example, at my local GP, when I said, no, I don't use the NHS app because I don't trust it. And to not use the sort of age argument, because they kind of look at someone who might be, you know, like 80 or something, and go, oh yeah, fair enough, he doesn't know how to use a phone. But actually, someone like me who's younger, to say something like that is just such a shock to all these people. And you think, oh my God, they literally trust everything that is put in front of them.
Well, I got that weird text message, didn't I, from the NHS? I got a text message from a personal phone number going, hey, can you just click this link? And it was written like they were my friend, which was everything that we teach about phishing, right? And how to socially engineer somebody. They could have picked up a letter from the post, worked it out, phished me on my phone. Easy. They've got the files. They could have hacked their system. So straight away, I'm on that. And I contact the NHS. I'm like, sorry, what is this? And instead of getting, I sent a lovely email, instead of getting back a decent response, I got a phone call saying, hello, you want to rebook? I said, no, I don't want to rebook my appointment. I want to have a discussion about the security of you just sending me a random text message with a random dodgy looking link. And then they just rebooked it anyway, and no one wanted to have that discussion. So I got punished. They literally cancelled my appointment and moved it back a month as a result of questioning a dodgy system, rather than getting any explanation whatsoever. And that.
Yeah, they're not equipped to deal with it. 40 years after our programs of digital literacy in the 1980s, when, you know, the idea in the highest levels of government was that we need people to be technically literate. 40 years after that, people are as utterly clueless and mindlessly trusting of technology as they've ever been. Worse than even
The stats showed that, right? I think last year it was a 2023 report showed that 92% of people are lacking digital skills to carry out their current job. That's terrifying. Employers, at the same time, employers were not prepared to pay for the training for them to do it. They expected their staff to find the time with both people working, all the family out the door 24/7. We're expected as employees to somehow find the training, pay for the training, and find the time to go. But we're not doing that. There's this huge disconnect. And again, that feels like that's that spreadsheet decision again, where someone's going, well, we could spend it on this, or we could spend it on marketing and increase value for an increase income. But at the same time, you're risking that your staff don't have the digital skills to carry out their job, or into the future, you're going to come to a point where it is going to get to a bad situation. And I think this is another example of that.
Yeah, well, you usually find that kind of after that period of finally getting breached, they just suddenly cough up all the money that they needed for that cyber training. And you think, that's convenient. You can find the money after you've been hacked.
The company to train the employees to do the job that they're being employed to do. I don't understand why digital skills are being shoved onto the employee as a responsibility that they need to do. And that's right back to your point, Andy.
Should we move on to that next comment?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
See what it says? Anonymous sourcer, I guess. Everybody's just doing their job. This relates to the system that is society. When something is broken, we just convince ourselves that everything is working as expected. People get hurt from it, but we don't really care enough to question it and make the necessary changes to fix it.
Back to the same old line of, well, it's not my job. How many times have we heard that as IT engineers and as cybersecurity people? You raise a problem and then with one person, you go, that's not my job. And then you go to the person who you think, you know, might be the next one. No, it's not my job. And you just end up in this big circle where no one wants to take responsibility to fix something.
Well, I remember the conversation we were having, Helen, about BT and Openreach kind of palming off different issues to you on the phone, going, oh, it's this department, oh, it's this department, oh, you'll have to find this department. And you end up in a massive chain of...
It was what happens with separate companies. They're one company. They split into two companies, you know, a lot like the Royal Mail and the Post Office, actually. They still work together, but they're now separate bodies. And so it's very easy to go, oh, no, it's the other person's role. And to be honest, I've worked in call centres where that's what everyone did on a Friday afternoon, right? Because we were all young. And it was, no, call customer services. They won't come back for another 20 minutes at least. We might be home by then. So it is that everyone's just doing their job. And sometimes we don't do the jobs to the best of our ability.
Well, I think there's a bigger culture thing here that's created, especially when you've got all of this tech nonsense to deal with, especially as an employee. You've got loads of training to do that's useless, paperwork and different systems to use that aren't working
and
properly.
What's your reward?
And everyone just gets so fed up, they just think, oh, I'm just palming it off now, I can't be bothered.
And no, it's not just that, but what's your reward for stepping outside of that and actually going above and beyond and going and helping this person or investigating this? Because I've done that before and I've been told, oh, sorry, that we're not really, I don't know why you're focusing on this, it wasn't raised as an issue.
Culture that going on there actively punishes caring and proactive
stepping outside the box of the normal system drudgery, basically.
People don't see any reason to go and do that anymore. They're low paid, they're badly treated, and there's very little chance of progression. So what's the motive for them to work an extra 20 hours a week other than empathy, which they're not rewarded for?
Or try and work around a system that's completely broken and just ends up in a spiral of chaos. They just can't be bothered. They go, oh, sorry, the system can't let me. I'll have to do something else. And they just stay like that.
Yeah, and fear for speaking out. Fear for, you know, if you're highlighting problems and fixing them and someone's rebuking you for that because, you know, it's something they weren't working on that week or it's something they haven't thought about and now they have to write a bloody document and tell their boss, that becomes a problem. It should, and I've had to have conversations with bosses before where, like, look, this has happened, this has been fixed, and you know what, you can play this to your advantage, right? Don't deny this. Go in there and go, hey, I just found this thing and then my team fixed it because I'm a legend. I don't understand why you'd not even bring it up.
I think that's just insane. A complete lack of progressive change routes in any system that's embedded within a company. You know, there's actually no way to flag it up because I'll go, oh, well, yeah, you can tell your boss or your manager or something, and then they might tell their manager, and they might tell their manager, and nothing changes. There's no route for change there.
All these systems are just massive bonfires of human intelligence that actively punish initiatives.
I remember walking into a boardroom before, and someone whispered under their breath, and I heard it. Oh, not her again. She only brings us problems. Well, I do cybersecurity, so yeah, the only time I'm in this room is when there's a problem. So that makes sense. That's what you hired me for. But also, like, you bring problems that you want fixed. They ignore the problems, and then you come back in that room a month later and go, so their internet's off and we've been ruined. You know, those problems I highlighted, if we dealt with them weeks ago, I wouldn't be in here with bad news today. And on the second, I'm leaving. See ya. Because you shouldn't stay in an environment where they are sleepwalking into a disaster. It's unethical for you.
Well, going back to that culture of fear and people not being able to raise any issues because they're just cowering in their job, living hand to mouth in debt and in fear of losing their jobs. Yeah. I mean, this is the late stage capitalist crisis that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And there's a great comment here from the internet. What happened here is that some people dared to question the hierarchy. Since that was impossible, it turned into a political circus where the authorities spent insane amounts of time and money trying to maintain an established order that was in fact broken. Dysfunctional hierarchies are defined by this kind of refusal to deal with reality when inconvenient facts are presented. It becomes more important to punish those who challenge authority than to fix the real problem.
Easier.
That nails it quite well.
Mm.
It does. It's always been easier. Did the Romans do that? Just shut the protesters. Just crucify them.
Yeah, I mean, it works for a while, but I mean, in the end, like, where's the Roman Empire now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We might be saying that about the post office in 5 years' time at this rate.
Mm, or sooner, yeah.
I don't know. I think even this comment kind of goes back to that same, where they use the word political circus. I think in any kind of, especially medium to large organisation now, there is just absolutely no route for change. Wherever you look, there's all these hierarchies that are created, a lot of them by systems as well.
It definitely depends on the industry. I've just come from industry. The creative industry is always up for changing, and it's rapid, course, that change. And I guess that maybe they need to look at funner industries that have got bigger financial challenges and work out how they're doing it, because they're doing it right. And their employees are happy and stay forever on low money. There's a reason that's happening.
Mm. I mean, there is a lot of businesses that I'm sure do get this right. But there's also, I think, on the contrary, more businesses that are not doing it right. And I think they're falling into the same trap of dysfunctional hierarchies and just this failing route of any kind of resolution for anyone, especially at the lower end of the hierarchy, having to use these systems that are just not functional. And they're just trapped in that kind of... that just cycle of rage and disappointment, and that then gets laid onto the customers or the patients or whoever else is involved, and there's just no route there out.
So an eerily similar debacle happening in Australia. Hundreds of thousands of people were issued debt notices for apparent overpayment of employment benefits that were miscalculated.
Yeah.
A similar case happened in the Netherlands. Many people living on government allowances had been paid too much. Instead of admitting the mistake, the government officials decided to just retrieve the money and sue them for fraud. Fault of society's near-blind assumption that expert equals truthful. Mm. That's an interesting comment.
Yeah.
That equating of expert with truthful.
Academics and scientists and experts are always debating. If you can find the answer to one thing, you're likely to be able to find the opposite answer very convincingly as well. Isn't that the whole point of debate?
That's the whole point of scientific method and disputation. That is the whole point, yeah? They disagree.
Mm. Okay.
So, I don't know how the ridiculous idea that a result of a computer program can be implicitly trusted got into the minds of people. I know how that happened.
Okay.
Yeah, 1950s and 1960s sci-fi. When computers kind of first came into culture, they were always infallible. And it wasn't until Space Odyssey that, so it's Arthur C. Clarke, isn't it? That's a landmark movie because it's the first time in science fiction ever that someone goes, oh yeah, maybe the computer's actually really f***ed up.
So Star Trek, which is a love of mine, is essentially to blame because whenever they get in a real pickle, they go, hey, computer, can you fix it? It goes, yeah, sure, I will.
Yeah.
If you watch like Star Trek in 2020 something, it's like, oh, is the computer okay? And they're like, no, someone's probably hacked it or it might have a virus. It's acting weird. So like there is... that's beginning to change. And so it's almost like that hasn't changed in popular culture until it's got so noticeable that they couldn't ignore it and hide it in, you know, a way anymore. Because it's not very nice, is it? It's much nicer to imagine technology's here and it's infallible and it rescues us and improves us. I guess it's not nice if maybe we don't want to, as people, admit that the things that we created might be a bit broken and might be actually not doing us any good.
I think it goes back to that loop again. Is like, we created the technology, but we're not maintaining it or even looking back and saying, hang on a minute, is it still working for X, Y, and Z?
Is it good?
But they just let it run and cycle and
And we're learning that so much when we look at how we treat our environment. You know, we now know that throwing petrochemicals on fields to produce more food might not have been a good idea. A bit too late now, you know, soil erosion's happening. We're having to really put up some science now to get that situation solved. And so problems are often started by the generations before us. And we often don't know that they're problems until we're confronted with it and it's gone horribly wrong. Back to what you said earlier, it's exploded.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
A familiar old phrase or saying is that somebody is blinded by science. And I think we can say the same of technology. And that many of the players in this story have allowed themselves to be blinded by technology. Let's go back over to Kate and hear a few words about what might be going on in people's minds when they put such absolute trust, blind faith in technology. Kate, is there something that we can do to make ourselves less vulnerable and less dazzled by technology?
I think if people don't have a strong sense of self, of who they are, they maybe aren't able to adapt to a change of circumstances. So, for example, they're not able to say, I'm going to whistleblow, protest, do the right thing in the light of this new information that means that actually I feel devastated that the institution that I invested so long in, it has now been proved to be corrupted. It's like they continue at any cost, because they identify so heavily with, for example, being the CEO and actually get accolades. There was an online petition to get Paula Vernels to hand back her CBE. But she's so invested in the accolades, she just couldn't imagine something else that she could do.
My thought was, do you think that that happened to Edward Snowden? Because the character, personality that I see with Edward Snowden is somebody who is deeply committed to the integrity of the intelligence agency, a true believer, and it's the true believers which really seem to flip out when they see what's crawling under the rock.
It makes me think of Chelsea Manning also.
So on the relation between incompetence and evil, there were a few amazing highlights in the ITV drama for me, and I assume they're at least a fairly close replica of what was really said. When Alan Bates says about incompetence and evil are basically the same thing. I mean, sometimes it takes a bold statement like that to deflate language and ideas that have become too inflated. And we all labour under the charitable idea that's given by that maxim, never attribute to malice what may be explained by incompetence. And what I think Alan Bates is saying is that there passes a point where incompetence becomes so pathological to allow it to continue is actually an act of evil. Those who are technically naive in positions where they're responsible for technology, then that's a grave wrongdoing, as I see it. And I think we're all colluding in excusing evil when we act as apologists for failed systems and for failed leaders that are unfit for purpose.
I want to get back to the issue of trust. So you've brought in my comment that if I ever needed a neurosurgeon, as much as I love you, I wouldn't necessarily trust you to do brain surgery because I know that you're not qualified. A sane and rational person would also know that they are also not qualified to do brain surgery. So they have got a realistic appraisal of their own limits and their own abilities and competencies and are able to say, it's not that you don't trust me to do brain surgery, but I also don't trust myself to do brain surgery. So even if you were screaming out, begging, there's still, no, I know my own limits. It's about maybe trusting oneself. And actually, I think that too often, maybe people have got particular psyches that are prone to misplaced trust and unquestioning kind of blind faith in untested systems.
I think when it comes to technology, that's most of us.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the psychological basis for the idea that one could be maliciously incompetent.
Well, if you think of the power structures in malevolent institutions and corporations, if these corporations are actually malicious and incompetent, then actually they're not going to promote someone that's going to challenge that. The post office would not have employed someone potentially with a conscience in that role who is able to say, no, I found something deeply worrying here and we need to investigate, hold our hands up and put right what we've done wrong. It's a kind of culture that says, don't bring me bad news. And that was so evident in the transcripts of the emails of, I need to be able to say this. And it makes me think of culture around safety and things like the how checklists can improve the safety of surgery. And actually the difference in cultures in surgery, the surgeons were really resistant to the idea of something as simple as a checklist compared to pilots. And with the pilots, they were more flexible because they had skin in the game and maybe, you know, a different psychological makeup to doctors and surgeons, more willing to kind of cope with their own fallibility. And I think it takes a truly secure person to be able to say, well, maybe I was wrong about that. And hey guys, maybe we are wrong. Maybe there are massive problems.
So there's a lot of insecurity going around. And that insecurity puts people into this vulnerable position where they fall into spirals of silence, where they're not confident in their own identity and their own ideas, and that this can become so bad that they stop believing clear evidence that's right in front of their eyes.
Yeah.
And that's what you call percepticide.
Yeah.
I think it relates really nicely to the technical and legal aspects.
A final point before I go, something that I find particularly tragic is that the previously benevolent loyalty that those post office masters had towards their role in the post office, that loyalty was a similar but very malevolent loyalty that stopped people like the CEO Vanels from behaving in an ethical way. And I think, you know, the betrayal felt by those postmasters must be really extreme.
Continue with that point for a moment, that the very same human instinct that drove the post office into utter intransigence and cruelty and a miscarriage of justice was precisely the same instinct which allowed the sub-postmasters to become such easy victims?
I don't think that they were easy victims. I think that that would be utterly, utterly victim-blaming. No, I don't think that. I wouldn't say that, you know, people like Bates were easy victims at all, but I guess it's...
Can I argue there? I think from the point of view of an ambivalent or malevolent machine, they are easy victims.
Right.
Because their loyalty is something to exploit.
Right.
And that may sound very, very cynical, but you have to understand how systems like that think. I mean, you could go back to the contract, which makes them personally liable for all their losses in the first place. How many people who signed that really understood it? Well, obviously, Alan Bates did, right? But people sign things 1,000 times a day without even realising it, and they have no idea what they're signing up to. And most of us lack capacity to even understand what is at stake. The system knows that we're all easy victim. And the more that AI gets behind those kinds of systems, the more it can personally craft misery for your life. So I'm bringing it back to the civic cybersecurity angle. How do we inform people like those 3,500 sub-postmasters, but the next generation of young people, to fortify them in such a way that they're not such easy pickings for malevolent systems? What Edward Snowden and I have both called digital self-defense. Why the hell do people trust technology at all?
I think it taps into really primal kind of dependency issues, that as a culture we have become overly dependent on malevolent technology, because there's something about culture that has allowed us to be overly dependent on certain technological systems.
In technology in general, because there's a lot of malevolent technology out there, but our hope is always that it is a benevolent tool.
But we've got to be able to understand that tool much better in order to assess realistically its how benevolent or malevolent it might be, or whether it's simply kind of...
Maybe that the project should not be to educate people technically, but what we need to understand is not the technology, but ourselves.
That's a really good point.
Why do we take up technologies? Why do we use them? What are we using them for? What's the purpose? I think that technology in the early 21st century is what we used to call a cargo cult. You know, things fall from the sky and people consume them and do so very blindly. And that technology in its present form is more of a habit that people have acquired without purpose. And if there is a purpose, then it lies outside their daily perception of it. It's an instrument of control and so on. But they don't see that. But if people better understood themselves and their relation to technology, that would be very empowering. So do you think that psychology, psychoanalysis and so on, has quite an important role to play in cybersecurity?
I think that what it does is shine a light on not only our practical and actual engagement with digital technology, but the unconscious forces like denial, like projection, and all the other defences.
So there's a conscious connection, yeah, with technology,
yeah,
that computer scientists and my colleagues would call UI, you know, UX,
yeah,
user experience, interface, yeah, design. But there's an unconscious, yeah, connection with technology too. That sounds, yeah, like a fascinating idea. Thanks so much, Kate.
Well, this is the end of the Post Office Part 2. Thanks so much for listening. And as always, please let us know your thoughts. We'd absolutely love to hear from you.
Thanks for listening to the Post Office. I really hope that we've reached the end in the biggest issues that are being raised here. But a part of me feels that we might be back here again sometime soon. Thanks for listening.